call to order the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Today is February 16th, and we have a few items on the agenda today. We're going to be having a work session on Senate Bill 247. That's the ODF&W fee bill. We're having a work session on that only for the purposes of moving it to Ways and Means without recommendation, where they can look at that fee bill in the context of the entire budget. We'll also be having a work session on Senate Bill 209 and 261, providing that we get the paperwork back on Senate Bill 209, and then we have a couple of public hearings. So we are going to start out by opening up a work session on Senate Bill 247.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Bill 247 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 247 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Okay, seeing none, so ordered. Or wait. I mean, no. Excuse me.
Yeah,
is there objection? Is there objection? Getting ahead of myself. Seeing none, so ordered. Okay. I got one of those weird looks from Floyd right there. I was like, ooh, wait.
There's just one little statement I need to be in there.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question.
Yeah.
Is this going to be the practice for fee bills?
It will be the practice for fee bills so long as there's not a substantive, it's on a case-by-case basis,
right.
To be honest. I discussed this one with both the co-chair of Ways and Means and the Senate President's office, and weighed in with my strong opinion that should happen with this bill in particular. It will not be the practice with all fee bills. We have a couple of fee bills coming up in session that have a fair amount of policy discussion.
So it's their new programs?
Yeah, those we'll hold on to for sure. If it's just adjusting fees on existing program, and if the fee goes up by this much, this is how much volume they can do. If it stays the same, this is what they have to cut. I mean, that's just a pretty much a strict Ways and Means discussion. And it used to drive me nuts as co-chair of that subcommittee in Ways and Means when the policy committees would have hearings without full context and then send down recommendations. And then we have to deal with the full context and then be faced with the either changing things or just going with their recommendation. But
I think that's a great idea. Let me just say, as a member of both committees, this is much more efficient.
Yeah. Well, and we're looking for some efficiency because we have a full calendar for the session. And I would also note on that last bill that to the extent that Senator Olson and yourself would like to put some work into working on that, I'm sure that he's not on the sub.
No.
But I have discussed the issue with the Senate co-chair, and he would definitely appreciate some input.
Great.
On what to do with those fees.
Yep.
So it's a complicated issue this session. So with that, we will move on to the next item. We're waiting on paperwork for 209, so we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 261.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Bill 261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Finance and Revenue be rescinded.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Finance and Revenue be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Colleagues, you remember this is the ballast water trip fee bill. There seemed to be a consensus on it in our last meeting. We had a pretty good discussion, I think. And I think this bill's ready to go. So any discussion, questions?
Okay.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Close the work session on Senate Bill 260.
I'll carry it.
Yes, Senator Olson will carry.
Yeah.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 261. I don't think I ever closed the work session on Senate Bill 247, so we'll do that at the same time. And now we're waiting on paperwork for Senate Bill 209, and once we get that, we will work that bill later in the session, or later in this meeting, if we have that. And so now we are going to move. We're going to move to Senate Bill 262, and we're going to open up a public hearing. So we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 262. Could you tell us a little bit about what that bill does and call up the folks from the DEQ to kick us off?
Chair Edwards and committee members, Senate Bill 262 increases the fees for the oil spill prevention program and expands the use of money in the fund to include planning and preparedness activities, declares an emergency, and is effective upon passage. There is a proposed -1 amendment on OLIS that requires the Department of Environmental Quality to report on penalties recovered for willfully or negligently discharging oils into water the state and under DEQ's use of the oil spill control fund.
Okay. Thank you. Want to kick us off, Palmer?
Sure. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I have with me here today Bruce Gillis. He is our program manager for our environmental cleanup and emergency response program, and he will be able to provide some testimony about the bill. But we are here in support of Senate Bill 262 and happy to answer any questions after Bruce has done his testimony. Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, I am Bruce Gillis, Cleanup and Emergency Response Manager for the Department of Environmental Quality Operations Division. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 262, Oregon's Oil Spill Contingency Planning Bill. DEQ works closely with the maritime and petroleum industry to develop and implement strategies for preventing and responding to oil spills. Approval of Senate Bill 262 allows DEQ to maintain resources needed to protect the marine environment from the risk of oil spills and to ensure that the spills are cleaned up quickly and efficiently. DEQ's responsibilities include review and approval of industry-prepared spill response plans. The 28 plans we now have are required of vessels and facilities that handle large volumes of petroleum products, and they provide specific procedures for spill prevention and spill response. Development of geographic response plans. Geographic response plans define pre-approved tactics for minimizing the damage to natural resources when spills do occur. Third, participation in drills and exercises with industry. These industry drills and exercises help ensure that adequate equipment is available and that the response personnel are properly trained to respond to oil spills should they occur. DEQ worked with stakeholder group to revise fees needed to pay DEQ's oil spill contingency planning program. When the program was originally funded in 1991, fees were intended to support four positions. The last fee increase was implemented in 2007. In the current biennium, DEQ is operating its program with less than 2.5 positions. As a result, DEQ has had to limit the number of drills and exercises we participate with industry. The proposed fees will support about 3 1/3 positions. DEQ can perform an effective level of service with this level of staffing and ensure of a viable program. We believe the fee increases we are proposing are supported by representatives of the maritime and petroleum industry. In the absence of any fee increase, DEQ will have to reduce staffing in the future to less than 2 full-time positions. At that level, DEQ would not be able to support meaningful participation in industry drills and exercises that will affect our response to marine spills. Senate Bill 262 would also allow DEQ to use funds from the Oil Spillage Control Fund to pay for training, response exercises, inspections, and other activities consistent with the intent of the Oil Spill Contingency Planning Program. Additionally, if Senate Bill 262 is amended, both DEQ and our industry partners agree that funding of the Oil Spill Controllage Fund and use of that fund should be included in the annual report required under 468B-412, which provides similar information with regard to oil spill contingency planning fees we currently collect. Oil spilled into waters of the state can devastate natural resources and seriously impact shipping and economic activities. Senate Bill 262 gives DEQ the ability to continue to effectively implement Oregon's oil spill contingency planning program, and we urge its passage. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for the presentation. Questions from the committee? I do have just a couple of questions. Could you clarify, and I mean, I've asked you off the record in my office, but if you could put it on the record, how this relates or does not relate to oil coming into Oregon by train.
Chair Edwards,
potential for spillage, and we just had a big accident yesterday,
right.
I guess.
Chair Edwards, this does not address Inland Railroad spill prevention and planning. That's something that's currently not funded, and we're not able to conduct with our current funding that we have for our spill program.
And if I might add, Chair Edwards, I think if there were an oil train spill, we would respond, and we have some capacity to do that. But what Bruce is, I think, really alluding to is, unlike this proposal and this program for pipelines and marine facilities, where we can actually do what I call preparedness, do drills, look to where the equipment is stashed, coordinate with industry ahead of time to try to get the best advantage if there were ever a spill, we don't have as much ability to do that with oil trains. The railroads do planning, and there are federal requirements around that, so I don't want anyone to have the impression that they don't plan and there isn't some legal requirement to do that. What's different, though, from these other facilities is there's no legal requirement at the state level for a plan to come to the department and require coordination with us, review, and or possibly approval over that plan. So that's the gap that we have seen with regard to railroads.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Olson.
Thank you. Your fee increases are pretty high. I just did some quick math, and we've got one that's 150%, another 75%, 57%, 50%. Are these supported by the industry?
As Senator Olson, as I mentioned in my testimony, I believe so. When we originally did the fee structure in 1991, we set a framework up that each sectors of the vessels would share an equal balance of the funds that DEQ used to support its planning work. The fees set in 2007 assumed 80 tanker trips per year. As an example, in 2014, we had 32. So we've been collecting far less than what we had projected in 2007. So that's roughly, we're about half or less than half of what we projected for vehicle or vessel trips for tankers. So the tankers, again, have a allocation according to that framework. And so that translated into a higher fee for that that vessel type.
Follow up.
So you projected, you estimated that you'd have 80 tankers, and you only had 32.
Correct.
And so you need the extra money is to go back to pay for the projected 80 tankers?
Well,
or the 32 tank. Let me rephrase that. The 32 tankers that you earn the money off of is not adequate to fund the system.
Not according to the original framework we had developed in 1991 that industry supported. So to balance that, then we had to raise fees on the larger vessels, the tankers. And that was, again, trying to be within the spirit of the initial agreements back in 91, and that's how we've operated since then, and industry has supported that.
Mr. Chair, do we have industry to testify on this?
I believe we do, but I'm not exactly sure what all the initials behind certain names stand for.
One other follow-up question. Sir, this money is to go into the oil spill prevention fund. That's in the bill.
There is
Has that fund ever been swept?
Not to our knowledge. Okay. The issue there, Senator, is that fund right now under current law limits us to using that for response. Mm-hmm. And it's a relatively small amount of money, $30,000-$50,000, something like that.
In fiscal year 2014, we collected $15,000 in penalties.
So what we're proposing, Senator, is to be able to use that money for preparedness activities rather than use it for response. It's such a small amount of money, okay. It wouldn't really work well for response. I did want to add, though, on the stakeholder issue, the steamship operators did reach out to us before this public hearing, and I just want the committee to know that they shared with us they had a concern about the effective date of the bill, and that they're asking for an opportunity to talk with us about moving that date maybe to the tune of 90 days, and we're willing to have that conversation with them. We just really haven't gotten down into the details. So I did want to share that with the committee, that they brought that to our attention.
Brings a continuing question. Why was it an emergency?
I think, Senator Olson, that was just fairly typical for us, just to write it so that it takes effect upon signature by the governor. And for us, it is, I will add, important for having the program get sufficient revenue as of August to do our activities, particularly the annual fees.
Follow-up?
Yeah.
How many people do you have on this emergency team?
For planning under this?
That actually responded to the emergency.
The response side?
Yeah.
I have 4 responders statewide.
Really?
That's it. And compared to Washington, our entire program is about one-tenth the size of Washington's. Yeah. Just to put it in perspective,
opens a whole new door. How do 4 people statewide handle this kind of response if we have an oil tanker break in half in the Columbia River?
Well, one of the things we try to do with drills and exercises is train some of our cleanup staff to give us depth that we wouldn't otherwise have.
Cleanup staff?
Yeah, the folks that oversee cleanup of industrial properties. They have the skill sets available to work on these situations, but we don't. Most of their job is working on cleanup sites, and we bring them the drills and exercises to train them in that environment so that if we need depth in a response like the situation that recently occurred in West Virginia, we have that depth. They walk into a situation knowing the role. They don't necessarily have the full level of experience that our 4 responders do, but they're able to step in and provide depth to our structure.
How many are those?
Our cleanup staff is about 50 statewide. We've trained about 8 of those and brought them to drills and exercises, and that's part of the extra money.
Trained 8?
8.
8?
8.
Out of the 50?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Senator Przonski, you had a question?
I do. I'm going to just follow up with Senator Olson kind of left off on. I'm assuming the reason we have just call it a skeleton crew is because of the resources that are available now. In the sense you don't have the funding just sitting there to be able to have a larger, let's say, presence than the 4, first of all. Is that a fair statement?
Correct. Our program used to get some general fund. That ended, I think, some 10 years ago.
Yeah, this is just what's attrition as to not having the money coming in and all that. So then for the 8 out of the 50, again, you're limited as how many you can bring in just because your resources are limited.
Correct.
So going back to this bill to raise the current fees, and I think Senator Olson might have been the one that asked this question, can you kind of give us the perspective of how much money you have in the bank right now and that you're operating, understanding that you've got these different programs that are getting ready to have their annual presence of additional training? It sounds to me like you're not sitting on a lot of cash. Because only 32 trips were paid for where you thought there may be 80, that there's some discrepancy as to keeping a functioning group or unit?
As I mentioned in my testimony, we're operating below what we would like to be operating at to support a robust participation in drills and exercises. That's getting that depth that we were talking about. So in the absence of the increase, we're going to have to keep that throttle back. And if there is no fee increase, then we have to reduce staffing. That's the situation. We were projecting that we would be out of money by now, but we phased back some of our work so that we could survive this time frame and get through session. And so that's one of the reasons we put in the emergency clause the way we did. We think we can operate as we currently are for an additional 90 days without suffering any adverse effects in how we're how we're supporting industry.
Okay, if I can follow up.
Yeah.
So I want to follow up. I guess, Palmer, maybe this might be for you. There's two parts to this. The first one is I understand that some of the shippers or carriers are wanting to work with the department and implementing this, wanting another 90 days. Have you gotten a sense as to why they would want or feel that it's appropriate or necessary to wait 90 days to attach the fees instead of, I mean, is there something happening over the next 90 days that's imperative for their position?
So, Senator Pruszynski, I'll share with you what they told me. They can also perhaps speak for themselves. So, but what I understood is this is the association that represents some of the facility operators in the Portland area who deal with the larger freight vessels that are coming from international ports and maybe even other state ports. And I think their interest is making sure that those vessels who start their voyage, much, maybe even months out or a long time out, have adequate notice about the fact that Oregon may change their fees. And they've essentially billed for that or accounted for those costs so that when they arrive, that the vessel operator is paying for it, not the facility operator here in Oregon. That's what it was explained to me, but quite honestly, Senator, we didn't have much time to really talk about this.
I appreciate
so,
that.
Yeah.
So I'll ask them. I guess the question I'm going to be asking is, I'm looking at the fees, $15 for the first one increase. The next one is $30, $40. And I'm looking at the capacities of the barrels. It doesn't seem like that should be into the mix of being concerned about before they leave port with their fuel to be being impacted like that. So, Mr. Chair, if I can just follow up. I want to, the other part that the chair brought up, which, of course, everyone's thinking about what happened in West Virginia, understand that we don't have direct authority or jurisdiction over the rails and understand how the federal system's set up. I'm assuming there's another fund or some other means that we deal with when there is a tractor-trailer rig that goes down. And because I remember hearing where these situations where it's been close to water, DEQ is out there. And so is what component is that as it pertains to your department, or is it another department? And can you give us just a little bit of that information?
Senator Pruszynski, we receive about funding from a petroleum load fee for tankers, a small percentage of that fee. The total is about $80,000. It pays about half a position. That largely covers our after-hours response team. So we have someone on call 24/7. So when it's after hours, we've got someone on a pager. So if something happens, we can mount our troops and respond. So that's largely what that funds is our after-hours support.
Okay. If I can, one other question. This is going to go with Senator Olson. I hate to even ask the question without knowing the answer. How many people do we have statewide to do that response 24/7? Because I can only envision if they're more in the heavier populated areas and we have something happening in a more rural area, the time it would take to get someone to actually respond.
Yes. Senator Pruszynski, as I mentioned, we have four on-scene coordinators that do the primary response, one in Eugene, one in Portland, one in Bend, and one in our headquarters office that is a floater that can fill in when folks are on vacation or sick leave or what have you.
Right.
Certainly, if we have more than one major incident concurrently, we're going to have a real challenge to effectively respond to both. That's you know, a burden I carry every day. It's you know, we did a tabletop exercise last, you know, I think February 5th, where we talked about some derailment scenarios in Oregon. And you know, I think one of the comments from the EPA, my counterpart with EPA, mentioned that, you know, DEQ really doesn't have that depth, and that EPA would have to help support our response if we had more than one significant incident in our state. That's a reality. We also have some fairly complicated weather systems that come through our state, and you know, over one weekend near Christmas, we had nine rigs on their side. So, you know, and those happen in one day. And so circumstances, you know, create challenges for us. You know, we've got an excellent, resilient crew, but there's only so many of our numbers.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, thank you. I have a couple of questions. They started to touch on it, but these are kind of ways and means oriented questions, but I guess I just can't help myself. So I don't know exactly what your ending balance is, but I mean, how many months of operation do you have? So that's one of the questions. And then what's the timing of when you notice the fee and when you collect the fee, and is that playing into your decision of wanting to be able to collect it right away? Is it, do you collect from different parties on a rolling basis throughout the year, or do all your notices go out on, you know, on July 1st?
Chair Edwards, the facility fees are paid once a year, and if the fee increase wasn't approved until January, they would not pay an increased fee this year. That would keep us short for a period of time. The vessels are on a per trip basis, so that's more of a regular stream flow.
Okay.
So we are collecting fees now that are supporting our current operations. But we are eating into the balance that we had on hand to cover shortages. We think we could probably limp through to the end of the year if we had to. But again, we'd have to rattle back and not support some of our drills and exercises to make that revenue last.
Are there other sources of funds that support your particular program, federal grants, other money, or is this it?
Well, Chair Edwards, I mentioned the small amount we get from the petroleum load fee. We actually recover about a little over one equivalent in cost recovery. So when we respond, we bill our time to the spilling party. So we do recover our costs that way.
Okay.
You know, we're not out on the site every day,
right.
And so we're not billing out every day. When folks are in the office. So they're following up on cases and, of course, you know, doing enforcement and things of that nature where necessary. But that's largely the balance of it, is cost recovery, about one position's worth, and then the fees collected for our planning and prevention, and a small amount for petroleum low fee.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Olson.
This is going to go to the financing part of it. You projected 80 trips, 80 vessels to come in 2007. You projected you'd have 80 trips, and you've had 32 tankers come in. What's your projection for the next year as the number of tankers that will come in? So, that, I mean, I'm trying to have you forecast your budget. If a tanker comes in and it's big offshore or self-propelled tank vessel, $2,100, do you anticipate having 10 of those come in this year, or –
Vice Chair Olson, what we did with industry is we sat down and we looked at the trends of the data over the last 7 years, and we tried to pick an estimate that we think is reasonable, that would be a close approximation to what will actually happen. So, again, since we were projecting fewer tanker trips, that reflected in the rate that we projected for that that vessel type. So that's what we did with industry in these work sessions, is sat down and looked at the data to come up with what's a good planning number for each of these sectors. And based on, once we had that, then we could estimate what fee rate we would need to fund the positions we were asking for.
But to follow up, that didn't answer my question. What's your projected budget? I mean, you had 7 years, you had 32 ships come through. That's what, about four ships a year? Is that what you projected your budget on, four ships a year?
I think that was his annual number, I think, 32.
Was it 32 ships a year that came in?
In fiscal year 2014, there was 32 ships that came in. So, in our annual report that I mentioned in my testimony, that's all laid out. The revenue we actually collected versus what we had projected in 2007. We used the data from that to project a new starting point for this fee increase.
Okay.
So that's how we approached it. And again, the total revenue requested is to support roughly 3.3 positions.
Which is how much money?
For a biennium, it's roughly 750,000. I'm guessing here. I don't have the numbers in front of me.
That's fine. Thank you. Mr. Chair, could we get a copy of that budget report?
I'm sure they would be happy to provide
it. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions for the panel?
Thank you both
for kicking us off on this particular issue. We're going to leave the public hearing open on this bill, and we're going to open up a public hearing also on Senate Bill 320, and we have a couple of distinguished gentlemen from the third row that are going to come and kick us off on Senate Bill 320. You guys can stand up now. I think you know who I was referring to.
The upper from the upper chamber.
That's right. Yeah.
From the upper chamber.
From the upper chamber.
Come on.
And, yeah, but you said gentlemen.
I did. Two mistakes.
Gray hair. I don't have any, so distinguished. It's always the gray-haired people.
So, and this is the bill on. You want to tell us just real briefly what the bill does before we turn it over to the panel?
Chair Edwards and committee members, Senate Bill 320 would exempt certain food establishments from having to obtain a domestic kitchen license if, in addition to other requirements, they are located in a residential dwelling and prepare baked or confectionery goods.
Go ahead.
Well, since I've got the hair, I'll go first.
That's right.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. Senate Bill 320 is a small home.
Who are you?
Excuse me?
Who are you?
Oh, I keep forgetting to do that. For the record, I'm Senator Bill Hansel from District 29. Senate Bill 320 is a small home business bakery bill. A few things would bring to your attention. It increases food access in communities where baked goods are scarce, stimulates economic development, generates entrepreneurial and micro-enterprise opportunities. It encourages direct sales of locally grown and prepared foods, improves the local food systems by easing barriers to local markets, improves self-reliance of Oregon communities. It's an exemption from the food processing licensing support of small-scale producers. It's home bakers selling local products that will have sufficient incentives to be accountable to consumers and provide safe, locally sourced foods. For example, I have a constituent in my hometown of Athena, a Mennonite woman, who bakes bread and sells it to members of the community. She sells this bread to generate additional income for her family. Senate Bill 320 encourages the direct sale of local grown prepared foods to the people in their area. They cannot sell the food to a commercial entity or institution such as a restaurant or a grocery store or school. However, they can sell them to farmers markets as a fundraiser. I am in support of Senate Bill 320. It's a good bill for rural Oregon, and would be happy to answer any questions when my colleague finishes.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and committee. For the record, my name is Arnie Roblin, and I am the senator from District 5, which includes the coast of Oregon from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and into the cities of Sheridan and Fall City. This is one of those bills about economic development and giving small business people the opportunity to get started without a large investment, and an understanding that there are niche markets along the coast in a lot of our small towns that aren't met by the big bulk stores and a lot of other things. And one of those is baked goods. And so if you look at farmers markets up and down the coast, in places like Coos Bay, we have a really great lady that does baking, and there's always a bakery there, and there's always a lineup of people around that deal buying bread and some of the other baked goods. In places like Tillamook, where they have a farmers market, one of the niche places they can't find is the baked good ones. And in Port Orford, another small community, when they have deals, we have a number of small entrepreneur businesses, a lot of fishing people and others, who could supplement their income by having the opportunity to bake goods and to sell those. And like we did with farms a few years ago, by letting them have their little markets on the farm to sell direct to people, it adds value to the work that they're already doing and gives them that little bit of extra money. We're talking about businesses that make less than $20,000. That's in the bill. So we're not talking about huge markets. We're talking about a business that we can get homegrown. And if they build it to a business that can do more, they then would have to go and get their licenses. But to begin with, that entrepreneurial spirit that we want in our little communities, and to give a little bit more spending money to many families who are just making it and are entrepreneurial in their own sense in other ways, this gives them that little bit of extra money like we did for farming communities around our state by letting them sell in little, in their own little markets on their farms. So I with our good Senator Hansel, feel very strongly that this is the kind of bill we need. You know, I've heard from a couple people, and I think you're going to hear some testimony later about the problems with it. And I speak as one of those people who sees it, understands that. My son was very allergic to milk, and bread isn't a good example, because the only bread we could find that didn't have milk in it that he could eat growing up was French bread. And so if there wasn't French bread around, we didn't have bread for him. And it was really kind of an interesting deal. So we started doing some of our own baking and others. My wife has a gluten intolerance, and there's a lot of people that are having that. With these farmers markets and these little small communities, most everybody knows everybody. They're going to worry about nut allergies and other kinds of stuff. And I will guarantee you they will figure out ways in which they make their products safe and produce things like gluten-free bread or bread without that's not been contaminated with nuts and other things. And I think because they know the person, they have been to the schools, kids know which kids have allergies and those kinds of things in some of these small communities, it will be, we'll be able to protect the market and do the right things for our communities and give opportunities that don't exist now. And with that is the opportunity that some of these people will donate some to the food bank and we'll have some others. And I think if we make sure that, and I think a lot of them would do it on their own, label things to make sure that they know that it doesn't have nuts in it or if it does. And I think most people, if they start selling something, are be careful enough to figure that out. And I know that there's people here that would help them with that as well. So I encourage you to give great consideration, and we'd like to see you pass 320.
Thank you both for your testimony. Senator Przonski.
You know, I hate to do this.
He's from the not. He's on the judiciary. They love doing this.
So,
he was asking a question.
So I'm looking at the definition. It says food or food establishment. I guess one of the concerns, on a serious note, knowing the committee I'm going to be in at 5 o'clock,
right,
dealing
right
with with marijuana and edibles. So, I mean, it seems to me if we're moving forward, clearly we want to have some parameters
I would think that would be true.
What is included versus what's not.
I think that's really important, actually. And I think that we need to make sure that we clearly identify what could or couldn't be in there, because a lot of people, I didn't know that I was going to have to read labels my whole life. But it's really essential. And if you don't have the ingredients on something, it's really difficult. So what you do is you don't do it because you know what it's going to cause you if it has the wrong things in it. Or you wish someone would make sure that the labeling is there and people know what's in these kinds of things. But in particular with your committee you're going to later, I think it's very important to have that conversation.
Thanks. Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just following up on the labeling issue, I think it is important that consumers have access to the ingredients. I don't know that it necessarily needs to be on the packaging right. of it. Just as if I buy bread from a bakery, often it doesn't include the ingredients, but I know they're available if I ask them for it. So, I wonder if either in the bill or through rulemaking, if that it doesn't make sense to have something like that be part of the program.
Yeah, I will tell you, just because of my family history with allergies, we have different events that take place, and one of them is a chili cook-off kind of thing in different places. And I always bring every can that I have that things ingredients came out of, because I know that there are people who would like to enjoy those things that people do, and at the same time, they're scared because they know what it will do to them if they get the wrong thing. And so I'm one of those people who thinks knowing what's in that is really, really important. And I think there's ways to make a lot, as you're making it, make a little, type up a little thing and have it next to the piece of the bread you're doing and make sure that it goes with it if you give it away to somebody so that they know it. And I don't think it has to be the same kind of labeling and all the kinds of things that we have in other places, but it should be consistent with respect to what you're putting in it. And I know the other thing is we need to talk to those people and as they decide to do this and make sure that they – we have a great group of people out there in the Extension Service that can actually tell you how to cook things and do things well. And if we had enough of those Extension Agent-type people, as you know, as something that I care about, you could make sure that they talk about, don't put your bread on a board that you had raw meat on. I mean, there's so many things that it would be good for people to know, and we have opportunities in this legislature. opportunities in this legislature to make sure that we have the funding to provide the kind of assistance they might need.
Awesome. Yeah, that you touch on it, Senator Rublin. Are you concerned about food safety issues?
Absolutely.
And so how does this bill protect consumers?
I think we've limited it to the kinds of things you can bake, which truthfully take care of almost all of the pathogens that could possibly be in there by heating them to a certain temperature and doing things. And so by limiting it to the kinds of things that it's less likely in the first place. And then number two, by when people decide to do that, I would hope that we would give them some information that says here's certain things that you should know about in not doing if you're going to, don't handle the raw chicken just before you pick up the bread to hand it to somebody. There are really simple things to do, and cleaning your hands, doing all that kind of stuff that I think people, if they're going to get in this business, should understand.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. I really think this is a good bill, and I would say that those people that are out there that are entrepreneurs that need this to raise further dollars, they understand that. They understand it, and their product will not sell if people get sick on it. So they follow up and they say, this is what I want to do. I'm proud of this product, and they'll cook it, and they'll do it the right way.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Any other questions? These fine gentlemen. Okay.
I have to say it was certainly a pleasure to be in front of this committee. Thank you.
Highlight of my day.
Pleasure is all ours.
We were promised bread.
It's coming. It depends on the bill. We wouldn't want to influence you ahead of time.
At least you didn't call us well-bred gentlemen.
Okay, we're going to leave this public hearing open. We're going to go back to our previous public hearing, taking testimony on Senate Bill 262, which was the oil spill prevention program. So heading back to that bill, Rob Douglas, you want to give us some perspective?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rob Douglas here today representing the Maritime Fire and Safety Association. You've heard about the tabletop exercises. You've heard about the drills. You've heard about the plans that are filed by folks with DEQ. That's us. In addition to that, we have boom. We have skimmers. We have rapid response vessels. We have equipment up and down both sides of the Columbia. And we have mutual aid agreements with fire districts on both sides of the Columbia to put in place this oil spill prevention and response system. I worked very hard on this issue in 1991. We didn't know if this was going to work, and it worked beyond all expectation. This is considered a model. If you talk to folks in the Coast Guard, this is a model for the rest of the nation. It works very, very well. going back to 1991, there's a reason those fees were put in statute, because that meant people had to come back to the legislature to get those fees changed, which meant prior to coming to the legislature, they had to work together, the agency and the stakeholders, to figure out what those fees should be, and that was done this time. Urge you to support Senate Bill 262.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, Senator Prozonski.
Rob, since you've been pretty involved and implemented in this area, knowing that there's now some discussions about delaying instead of having it go in effect upon signature 90 days, do you or your organization have some type of perspective to share with us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you have me at a decided disadvantage. The first I heard about any potential delay was today.
So basically, the group that's worked on this understood this was going to be moved forward with an emergency clause?
That's my understanding, and I confirmed that with the executive director for MFSA today.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Rob. Next, call up Claudia Keith and Mark Landauer.
Committee, thank you for having this public hearing today. I'm Claudia Keith, a member of the League of Women Voters Oregon Action Team. I'd like to give my testimony. I apologize, I'm not sure if you all got my letter. So I apologize for that. It was late. And we are aware that this bill is not related to the oil train issue. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. Since the 1950s, the League has been at the forefront of national efforts to protect air, land, and water resources. The League's position is that members work to preserve the physical, chemical, and biological integrity of the ecosystem with maximum protection of the public health and the environment, with a focus on demanding pollution prevention. Our testimony in support of Senate Bill 262 is consistent with the League's national position and focused on pollution prevention rather than rapid cleanup and post-spill settlement. Any major increase in fossil fuel industry infrastructure is not congruent with the current National League's climate change position. Our members are actively working all over the country to address greenhouse gas reduction and reduce the effects of climate change. The pollution from fossil fuels not only increase greenhouse gas emissions, but the pollution from their usage across the Pacific returns to Oregon via air currents and adds to the CO2 parts per million, higher than what it's 14.2% higher than what is deemed required for stable, eco-friendly climate. With the production of domestic oil in Montana and North Dakota, increased rail and vessel shipment of crude oil has already begun. In many parts of the country, record volumes of oil are moving by rail and vessels with multiple spill-related accidents. Some major accidents include Quebec province, the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, which is now 4 years into their cleanup process, and just this past week, the West Virginia massive oil rail explosion. Because many of the oil transport facilities and infrastructures go through or are located in highly populated areas, the potential for human danger is high. Additionally, the Columbia River, River fragile ecosystem is at risk. Senate Bill 262 is a first minimal attempt to address appropriate funding for comprehensive prevention measures. Preparedness related to education requirements and other relevant efforts to prevent the public and environmental strategy that can accompany oil spill accidents and associated with existing insufficient vessel and rail standards and shipping practices. The League of Women Voters urges your support for Senate Bill 262 as a first step in addressing this very serious issue. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mark.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here today on behalf of the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. We are supportive of the intent of this bill. I want to make that very clear at the outset. Needless to say, the funds for this program are vitally important, and of course, we do have experience in the state of Oregon. I recall very clearly when a certain ship off the South Coast broke into, and we had some pretty serious oil challenges and fuel challenges as a result of that that catastrophe. I will get right to the point that Senator Prozanski has been asking. We have asked for a delay in the implementation of this fee, and I want to provide a little bit additional information. If it were delayed, we are more than open, and in fact shared with Mr. Mason, that we would be happy to have the fee increased in order to recover the full amount of the fee that would have been lost as a result of the delay. The issue for us is that the steamship operators would end up paying the increase for those ships that have disembarked from their ports and are in transit to the West Coast and then docking here. The operators would then end up having to pay the difference in the fee if it was increased. We want to ensure that the agents and the people who are moving the freight ultimately are the ones that pay the fee, not the operators of the actual vessels themselves. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have, but that's really the crux of the issue from our position. And quite honestly, I've been hired by this organization since 1 o'clock, so Mr. Douglas's experience on this is far greater than mine. But I did want to share that issue with you and tried to let the Department of Environmental Quality know that we did want to have a discussion about that. And it's in no way an attempt to undermine or avoid an increase in fees, rather just ensure that the people who ought to be paying it do pay it. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Landauer. Do you know how many ships are in transit right now?
At this point, I have not checked.
Like you don't know.
O'clock. Okay. No, sir.
Then I would ask a question of the chair and the committee. If we were able to amend this bill, could we make it? Can we put an amendment in there that said it would start 90 days from now, and they would pay the back charges?
We'll have to consult with legislative counsel on how you would structure that. I'm not going to say yes or no. I'm open to this whole discussion. This is all new information, so we're thinking it through right now.
I guess I would say that if they're willing to pay the back fees or the fees that they would have lost from that point, then there would be no harm, no foul. They'd still get the money. They just wouldn't get it immediately.
Chair Edwards, Representative Olson, that's our intent. Excuse me, Senator
Olson. Okay,
forgive me. That is our intent. We're not here to try to undermine the program in any way, shape, or form. In fact, our organization is supportive of this program, needless to say. However, we want to, again, ensure that the individuals who should be paying this are paying it rather than the operators of the vessels themselves. Oftentimes, these vessels are owned by very large companies but are actually manned by other organizations or entities, and it's a complex industry, as you can imagine, and again, we just want to ensure that the rightful people who should be paying it are paying it.
Well, follow up. Mr. Chair, then maybe we could bring up Mr. Mason and see if they would be amenable to do that.
On the fly, I don't think he's probably authorized to say yes or amenable.
But he's saying yes.
Well, I'm not going to put him in that
position.
He's
saying yes, he'll come up. Yeah. He's not saying yes, he'll do it.
That's what we're here for, sir, is to fix this stuff.
I know. Sometimes it gets fixed in the hallway, and then we come back in here.
That's right.
Then we go down to legislative council. Then we get it drafted.
And then we fix it.
Yeah. Senator Prozanski.
Mr. Chair, so Mark, between you and Palmer and the agency, if you all can just give us kind of the perspective of the 32 ships that came in, what size they were. I'm just kind of looking at these numbers.
Yeah.
And I mean, I got to tell you, I don't see this somehow stopping the shipment from coming in when it's, you know, I understand that the ones I was pulling off were non-self-propelled, and so those must be barges. I'm assuming the self-propelled are the ones that are 300 gross tons or less. $15 is the difference. And then I can see, and I'm not sure if we have any, the 300 gross tons are over. That is a piece of, you know, that's $900. I can see that and the ones above. So it'd be interesting to kind of know what, how much impact we're really having. I mean, I can't see the ship turning around for $15.
Chair Edwards and Senator Prozanski, I'm sure that the captain would pull out his billfold and pay the $15 just to get on with it and clear a dock. However, you know, there are some substantial fees here, and again, our pure intent is just to ensure that the appropriate individuals are ultimately paying the fee rather than the actual folks who are operating the vessels. I was told earlier today that approximately 1,400 large vessels enter the Columbia River system on an annual basis, and that's a pretty significant number. However, if you compare that, of course, to a port like Long Beach, which is the largest on the West Coast, they're receiving somewhere on the neighborhood of about 6,500 vessels a year.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Okay.
Thank you.
No more questions. Thank you both. To be continued. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on that particular bill, which was number 262? Anybody else want to testify on Senate Bill 262? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 262. We still have the public hearing open. We left it open on Senate Bill 320, which was the home business bakery bill. And we're going to call up the next panel, and one of them is on the phone. So that is Annalise Curler, Sharon Thornberry, Luann Anderson, and David Brock Smith. And I believe, is it Luann that's on the phone?
Yes.
Okay, Luann that's on the phone. So Luann, if you can hear us, can she hear us right now? Okay. Okay, and then she can go on mute, and then
you want to check, she should be there now.
Ms. Anderson, are you on the line?
Yes.
I am.
Perfect, thank you. So we'll just let people go ahead and testify. If you just put your phone on mute until it's your chance to testify.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank
this
you.
This is right. Not fair.
Get the pocket
point
knife.
Of order.
Get the pocket knife out.
Some sort of.
If there's no knife and butter.
And a whole glass of red wine.
I feel like there's...
Yeah, don't forget the ball.
Permission to show
an ethical gray area right here.
Permission to,
I think,
show
it's another $50.
as long as
they
let
share
it slide
while they're
this
with
time.
Us, I think the ethic rules under $50, yeah. And they're with us, you know.
So
we'll leave the dough. I mean, the flour.
Annalise, you want to kick it off?
Absolutely.
Or if you'd like somebody else to.
No, I think I will kick things off. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Annalisa Curler, and I work for Oregon Food Bank. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 320. As Senator Roblins and Hansels testified, Senate Bill 320 is a small business bill that makes it easier for folks who are interested in starting a home baking business. Currently, you need a food processing license to do so, and we've heard across the state that is a barrier for many folks. Senate Bill 320 removes that barrier for low-volume, low-risk baked goods. Oregon will be joining 41 other states with similar laws. Food safety is very important to Oregon Food Bank. We would not be pursuing this bill if there are any serious food safety concerns. Oregon Food Bank is in the food business. We, in the past 3 years, each year alone, distribute over 80 million pounds of food throughout the state. We are well-versed in food safety. We believe we have designed a bill that limits many of the food safety concerns. In particular, we've designed a bill that limits it to baked goods that pose little or no risk to end consumers. If you take a look at the PowerPoint, you'll see a list of foods allowed and not allowed under Senate Bill 320. In particular, you'll notice that meats, fish, anything that requires refrigeration, and marijuana are not allowed. In addition, all items sold will need to have a label that state that this item was made in an uninspected facility and a home kitchen. All producers will need to follow food safety guidelines, and ODA has the authority to inspect a facility if they have food safety concerns. Additionally, many baked goods are naturally low risk as heat kills many microbes. We spoke to the Oregon Health Authority, and in the last 5 years, they have had no outbreaks due to baked goods. They also checked the CDC and had the same result. We also spoke to OSU Assistant Professor of Food Safety Systems, Joy Waite Cusick. She specializes in food safety. You'll find a letter from her testifying to this in your packet, and she says that these goods in Senate Bill 320 do not cause any foodborne illnesses. We believe that this will be an important bill for many Oregonians. The bill will stimulate economic development. It will help folks on small fixed incomes earn just a little bit more to make ends meet. Additionally, aspiring food entrepreneurs will have the opportunity to test the waters before launching a full-fledged business. It also addresses a key food need in Oregon. I'm going to introduce Sharon Thornberry right here to speak to that in more detail.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and the committee. My name is Sharon Thornberry. I'm the Community Food Systems Manager at Oregon Food Bank. I've been working in rural communities in Oregon for nearly 30 years now. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 320. Over the last 15 years, we've worked with rural communities to build food security from the grassroots up. Our approaches have included community food assessments, grocery store surveys with rural stores, and a variety of community organizing models. We work with communities to identify opportunities and the means to accomplish them. Many of the things we identify can be resolved locally. Others need support from outside of the community, and some need policy solutions. A policy solution is required to address the need for bread and confections in these communities. Many rural stores in Oregon communities with small populations and lower sales volumes do not warrant bread deliveries from wholesale bakeries. Stores in Lostien, Dayville, Minnehaha, Lake County, and even LC, only 35 miles from Corvallis, have difficulty getting ordinary loaf bread delivered. These same communities have many talented and conscientious home bakers and cooks who could be providing high-quality baked goods and confections to members of their community and earning much-needed supplemental income. We received endorsements for SB 320 from over 100 individuals and 29 organizations and businesses representing 25 counties in the state. Most of us don't think twice about having a loaf of bread to make those sandwiches for kids' lunches, rolls for dinner, or a birthday cake for someone we love. The reality is that many rural Oregonians do not have that luxury. We also know that a fresh-baked loaf of bread can nourish the body and soothe the soul. You can make that kind of bread available in Oregon's food deserts. SB 320 can help solve this situation, promote much-needed economic development, and improve food security throughout Oregon. I'm going to introduce Luann. I'd like to introduce Luann Anderson, who's on the phone. She teaches in the one-room schoolhouse in Plush, Oregon, and she's speaking to you from her classroom today.
Great. Luann, you're on. Unmute if you haven't yet.
All right, how's that?
Great.
Sounds great. Right. So my name is Luann Anderson, and I work in South Oregon as a one-room school teacher, currently with grades pre-K to third. I'm also part of a group trying to grow or bring fresh produce to Lake County at a reasonable cost. In Lake County, a food desert, we have one supermarket, Safeway, located in Lakeview, and several rural markets in outlying communities from 40 to 100 miles away. Recently, Friends Bakery has stopped all delivery of fresh bread to these outlying communities, insisting that owners of the rural markets can just come into Lakeview and buy it from Safeway, as it was not cost-effective for them to continue service due to a low customer base. This may be devastating to the desert communities of Adel, Plush, Paisley, Christmas Valley, and Silver Lake. SB 320, the Small Business Baking Bill, may be the answers we are looking for to alleviate this and stimulate our little communities at the same time by providing a huge service as well. There are many people in Warner Valley that could easily fill this bread void if given the chance, if this bill becomes put into law. Every one of us currently holds a food handling card and would enjoy producing goods while being part of a local solution that addresses a fundamental food security issue. For instance, Gene makes sourdough and produces great rolls, loaves, and even cinnamon rolls. I make awesome pizza dough and multi-grain breads every week. We are now able to access the Bountiful Baskets program, and some people are adding the bananas, pears, apples, and zucchinis to breads and cakes, even in the wintertime. Here in Warner Valley, we live 150 to 175 miles from any major grocery warehouse, which for us would be Cash and Carry or Costco. We are serviced by two major highways, 140 and 395, and at times must go over three mountains just to get enough food to feed everyone at a funeral or a wedding. All of us are adamant about food safety and see this bill as a lifesaver, especially in an emergency. We in Warner Valley would like to see SB 320 become a bill. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony, Luann.
All righty.
And you're welcome to stay on the line in case we have any questions.
Oh, okay. Great.
David? Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, committee members, I'm David Brock-Smith, Curry County Commissioner. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today in support of SB 320 on behalf of the residents of Curry County and the Curry County Board of Commissioners. Accompanying my testimony today is the Curry County resolution supporting SB 320 that reads, whereas a comprehensive economic development strategy, CEDS, 2014-2018 for Coos Curry Douglas counties in Oregon identifies the economic vision for the region to include value-added agriculture, employment, a successful small business base, and outstanding tourism products. And whereas the objective in the CEDS plan calls for all levels of government to work together to reduce regulatory requirements which can slow and stifle economic development opportunities and the need for fair permitting procedures. And whereas overly burdensome regulations limit small food business entrepreneurs in meeting the demand for low-risk baked goods and confections. And whereas proposed legislation SB 320 would exempt small home businesses that produce low-risk baked goods and confections from certain state licenses, food safety and sanitation regulations, while putting labeling standards in place, ensuring the public the value-added product was produced in an uninspected kitchen. Now, therefore, the Board of Curry County Commissioners hereby resolves as follows. In an effort to diversify the economy by adding value-added products, support small business, increase gross sales, and offer locally made tourism products, the Board of Commissioners hereby urges the Oregon Legislature to pass SB 320 and additionally encourages the other 35 counties in Oregon to support said legislation as well, signed by the Curry County Board of Commissioners. Curry County's rural economy is diverse, like many counties throughout the state of Oregon, and the ability to work with what you have is essential for survival. A recent example of this type of economic development was my work with the ODA and the USDA late last year. With the help of the ODA, we were able to achieve a rule change on the issuance of a USDA phytosanitary certification on frozen cranberries, blueberries, strawberries, and cherries. This change allows now our agriculture producers of these products throughout not only Oregon, but Washington and Idaho, the ability to receive the necessary certification to export these products overseas to China and other countries that require the certification. 99% of the cranberries grown in Oregon are grown in Coos and Curry counties.
And the overall economic impact of these four products within the state is over $2.8 million. This change will have an enormous economic benefit for our agriculture producers in Curry County and throughout the state of Oregon. Although this is good news, Curry County's rural natural resource-based and tourism-driven economy is still hurting. With a seasonal adjusted unemployment rate of over 10.4% December 14, in comparison to the state of Oregon's 6.7% of the same month and year, the continual decline of natural resource-based employment and the lack of necessary funding to support basic services to our residents, there is little to no economic growth throughout the county. These problems are compounded by an aging population of retirees that live on fixed incomes. Like the phytosanitary change described above, Senate Bill 320 would allow the flexibility for residents of our Oregon counties to produce a needed good while supplementing their income. My board and I see this as a win-win for our residents and those throughout the state. Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, and committee members, I thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I encourage your due pass recommendation on SB 320. This legislation is a small step to help grow local economies, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thanks for making the drive up.
My pleasure.
Any questions for any of the panel that's here before us?
I just wonder if we cut that ribbon.
We've got a knife. This is a loaf of semolina sourdough that was made by a home baker. It contains wheat flour, water, a sourdough starter, and salt.
I do have a question.
Sure.
So in the slideshow, when you first started out, there was a picture of cupcakes with a slash through it.
Yeah.
Is it because the frosting,
yes,
or is it okay?
Yeah. So oftentimes frosting requires refrigeration.
Okay.
But there are frosties that don't require refrigeration. So, okay. And I would tell you, all of you, that I managed the deli breaking for Kroger Corporation for 6 years. I'm very familiar with what's hazardous and what's not and so on. We would not be supporting this if we did not feel this was safe. And I really think that, you know, we're going to follow this bill through rulemaking. And we do a lot of outreach. We're a part of Oregon Food Bank that's working on building community food systems, and we provide a lot of educational materials and outreach, and we work closely with the community food systems and small farms folks and extension folks at OSU. So we're going to continue to make sure that we're providing people the information they need to do this safely.
Thank you.
Thank you. The cupcakes were gone, but apple turnovers with the sugar frosting on top.
Yes,
are they
you may
in,
have those.
Are they in or out?
They're in.
So how do you form a complete delineation with sideboards so everybody knows what's in and what's out?
Well, you know, we'll have a list like this, and then there'll be other things. The primary thing is it something that requires refrigeration if it's made? You know, sugar's one of those things that turns a lot of perishable things to non-perishable, thankfully. So if it's like cream, or if it's a French buttercream versus most buttercreams that you get on cakes at a bakery, are actually made with a shortening product, a vegetable product, versus a butter product. So they're non-perishable. So, you know, we'll make sure we're educating people about that. But we heard Luann. I've got to tell you, the folks out there who would be doing this, they don't want to make their neighbors sick or their customers sick. And they're going to be very, and they know.
Well,
they're
only,
very experienced.
It was only the apple turnovers I was worried about.
You get the apple turnovers.
First, a comment, then I think a question just to follow up on the testimony. We choose, my wife and I, to basically buy artisan breads. There are three commercial bakeries for the most part, and I'm very amazed at every time I hear in the Eugene area a new bakery is opening up. I'm going like, what are they going to do? Because there's like eight or nine of them, but they always seem to impress. And I know at the farmers market, some of those, as well as some other organizations that would not meet this threshold because there's more than $20,000, I'm assuming they're bringing in, are doing great product. So I see this as we've heard from the situation in Lake County and others where you could actually see an opportunity to have commerce and also nutrition, of course, there And since I ride through Alsey, it would be nice to be able to get a nice, good good bread there. I do want to go back to the slide and the conversation you're saying that marijuana would not be allowed. I've looked at the bill. Maybe I just missed it. Are you saying in the rulemaking it would be?
It would be in rulemaking.
So I appreciate that.
And we're going to follow it through rulemaking to make sure that these things get in the rules. I worked very closely with Oregon Farmers Market Association and ODA on the Farm Direct bill. And we'll follow this one the same way.
And I appreciate that, but I think that for our comfort, we may actually want to put something in statute just to ensure that that's covered.
Absolutely, and we're absolutely open to that. And I would say, in addition, we have been working closely with Measure 91 committee staff on this exact issue to make sure that it gets captured there as well. The intent of this bill was not.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, Senator.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I thought I heard someone, I think it might have been someone on the dais, say that this could perhaps get homemade bread into the food banks. Is that going to be possible under this?
No.
Is there any way we could do that?
That
is such a beautiful loaf. People at the food bank should
have the power to make that decision at Oregon Food Bank. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, what is it that controls that? I know that it's
belong to a national organization called Feeding America, and there are certain rules that we abide by because of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and is the rule? I mean, does it say that it has to be limited to commercially produced?
Usually, yes.
And this would not qualify as commercially produced.
No, but one of the ways I could see this being helpful to us is we're doing a lot more nutrition and cooking classes, so we could actually teach people to do baking, which could get them started in a small home business that eventually would become licensed because their volume would be great enough that they would do that. This is also how many great recipes are put together and actually purchased. People sell them all to the food industry, and this is how they start.
Thank you. Yes, if I could just follow up. Yeah, I've been so impressed with the cooking classes that our local food banks do. And, you know, it's a way of getting people to self-sufficiency. And, I mean, that loaf is so beautiful, but it probably didn't really cost that much to produce since it's just flour and water. And helping people to see that, you know, if they have the time, you know, they could produce this themselves.
I'll pass.
Okay. Any other questions for the panel? Thank you all for being here.
Thank you,
Luann, for calling in. Next, I'm going to call up Ian Tollison. May have a little different perspective. I hope that he also brought props.
So he better have.
I didn't.
Uh-oh. There it is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ian Tollison with Northwest Food Processors Association. I will start with, we agree with this bill. The premise is fine. Everything that was said, you know, agree with about 99% of that. Everything is good there. I would say that there are challenges that we've seen when foods are produced and there's not really proper sideboards just to give the information that I think consumers want, whether regardless of what setting they're in. So I think the allergen issue is something that should be looked at, whether if it's cross contact with material services that touched peanuts or almonds, or you have almond flour in the air. So it'd be nice to have a little bit stronger language in the bill that would just try to label that. So I think there's definitely it's a good bill here. I think it could get a little bit better with some amendments regarding labeling. Also, I'll say traceability is a big deal if there is a foodborne illness. So that label could possibly include a PO box number or phone number just to help identify any possible outbreaks that happen in the future. Washington State does a pretty good job of this. They have a pretty good program. What home producers do there is they submit recipes to their Department of Ag, and then they'll work with the food producer and just let them know, hey, this is an issue here. You know, just be careful of an allergen, or you might not want to have pets around when you're cooking it. Have a food handler's permit. Some of these things that just provide a little bit more guidance. I'll say, you know, we're coming at this with a perspective of, you know, today's home kitchens could very well be tomorrow's big Sara Lee or Franz or whatever. So we're very supportive of this. It would just be good to have a little bit more sideboards and parameters set up around this for food safety concerns.
Thank you for that testimony. Questions for Ian? I do have a question. So I get where you're coming from. Are you worried that it'll be, I mean, what I'm hearing is you're concerned about food safety generally as an association. If they're not your members, why do you care? Or why does your association care?
And that's a great question, Mr. Chair. Thanks. Food safety is our number one concern. Whatever we do classes on it, training. We care. We train members and non-members on food safety. What's good for one member of the food industry is really good for all of us. For instance, fresh spinach was recalled a few years ago. And the fresh market was hit, but so was packaged, frozen, canned. So when we have food out there that has a food safety risk, I think it's incumbent upon the entire industry to say, well, what can we do to help that? And in fact, our association has an associate member spot, which is free. You don't have to pay to get that membership, but you get access to a lot of the food safety information. You get reduction on training classes, those sort of things. And that was a distinction made by the board to say it's important for all of us to have safe food out there.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Questions? Okay. Thank you. And the final person that has signed up on this issue is Patty Whitney Wise.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the Director for Partners for Hunger Free Oregon and also staff to the Oregon Hunger Task Force. The Oregon Hunger Task Force does conduct field hearings around the state, and we've done it in conjunction with the work that the Oregon Food Bank has done in local communities around food security. We hear about the great progress they're making and also the kinds of barriers that they face in making sure that they have food security in their local communities. This is an issue, this home baking, that has come to our attention, and we are in support of SB 320. I would just perhaps add a comment to the last person who testified that this bill is modeled on 41 other states that have similar bills, and I would hope that it would not have so many stipulations in it that it would actually discourage the small business opportunities and the opportunity to get nourishing food into people in many of our rural communities. And it is for that reason, for that personal nourishment and personal dignity, that we support this bill. Not only helps with the food system issues in local communities, but it provides economic opportunity for local residents. So I urge your support of SB 320. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Patty. Any questions for Patty? Okay. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I would like to call back up somebody, not the whole panel doesn't have to come up, but somebody to speak to the concerns that Mr. Tolleson brought up, because, you know, some of them sound like some sensible concerns, and perhaps they could be addressed. And if you don't think they can be addressed, I'd like to know why, or if you do think and you could work cooperatively to get them addressed, that's always nice too. So I'm interested in your perspective. Specifically, he brought up, he said there could be allergen issues, cross contact, things like almond flour in the air. Mm-hmm. They're interested in traceability, like P.O. box or phone number on the label, and then perhaps a Washington State model. So
food handler license.
and or food handler license, which sounded like another bar, a little bit higher, but go ahead.
Absolutely. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, again, my name is Annalisa Curler, and I work for Oregon Food Bank. So to address some of the labeling concerns, in the bill itself, it talks about how ODA has the authority to change the labeling requirements as due to federal regulations. And our understanding of federal regulations in regards to allergens is that indeed, in fact, you do have to list that kind of information. If it's something that people are more comfortable with having spelled out in the bill, we are absolutely open to having that amendment. And I would say, in general, we are open to adding to the bill in ways that will make it better, and that seems like one of them. Now I'm trying to remember the other
food handler's card.
We are absolutely open to having a food handler's card requirement. It is something that we talked to the Oregon Health Authority about, and what they said to us was that while they don't think it's necessary, of course they would welcome anyone applying for a food handler's card.
It's not a prohibitive requirement. It costs $10. People can do it online. I don't have an issue with that. To address the allergen issue and flour in the air, that doesn't happen in a home bakery setting or a home kitchen setting because you aren't producing huge batches of anything with powerful mixers that send the flour into the air. Most likely you're going to be doing small batches, so you're not going to make one thing and then have so much product left that you're going to be contaminating the next thing. It's really not likely to happen. And I also want to go back to the fact that I think, these products have to be labeled. And if it's like a cake, like a decorated cake or something, the requirement is that the label goes with it. I happen to know that I often get things at a bakery, and I don't get a label with them. But this is going to require that the label goes with any product that the person takes out. This is a direct responsibility kind of bill. Most of the folks are going to be selling to friends and neighbors and people that they know. And if they don't do things right, they're going to very quickly destroy their business. They really do have to answer to their customers in a face-to-face kind of way. So I don't see that as a huge concern. Okay. And I'm a person who has lots of food allergies.
And so one of the comments that was made was you spoke to the label that it needs to be labeled. So the issue of traceability doesn't sound like it's a big problem.
No, the label that we're going to recommend for this has the person's name and their physical address and a phone number. And that's the same label that's used across the country for states that have these sort of laws.
Okay. Then are you familiar with the Washington State model? And I only ask because that's the one that was mentioned.
Well, recipe review is very expensive, and so would be prohibitive.
So the Washington State model is actually more expensive than what we have currently with our food processing license.
What makes it more expensive?
The recipe review is one of the pieces that makes it more expensive, the cost of a recipe review. In our state, that primarily has to go to the Food Innovation Center, and then there are some private companies that review that. But it can cost you $1,000 to have a recipe reviewed. Yeah.
I've never heard of that. So what are they looking for?
They give you the nutritional content. They tell you about, what the issues are with the kind of I've never had it done. I've just talked to people that had it done. But if you want further answers, I can give you details about what that involves.
Never heard of it. Thank you.
Yeah. It's something that big companies have to do. If you're going to produce, thousands of loaves of bread, you have to have the recipe reviewed. Okay. Usually within a bakery company, they would have that expertise or they have a contract with somebody that has that expertise. It's not a prohibitive cost when you're producing at that volume.
And Senator Thompson, were you? I asked about the food handlers cart ride. Said something about it, and Annalisa said something
comment.
About
I,
it. You
I,
seem to know something about
that. I went
to that.
Serve waffles at the Boring Grange, and they required me to have a food handler's license to donate my time to do that. So it's real easy, and it costs $10. And
it's
and
simple.
It teaches you about keeping your hands clean. Real simple things. That,
yeah.
So I think it wouldn't be a bad thing if they had to do that.
Yeah, it could require my kids to
if I have to do it.
Well, I didn't have to do it.
Yeah, I was going to say,
well,
didn't make me do it either.
One of the things I would tell you that all of you should know is that actually in restaurants, they only require one person per shift to have a food handler's card.
Huh.
So you don't have to necessarily. Most restaurants now require it of all their employees. But And in terms of nonprofits, a lot of nonprofits are now asking everybody to have one, which was what Luann was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
She also cooks for the wildland firefighters in the summertime. So, you know, these folks provide food to the community down there. But it's not necessary that everybody that's serving food in a certain shift have a food handler's card.
I'm not positive that that's correct. But,
okay.
Unless you want to get the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association in
okay.
here and
yeah.
working you against the bill. I don't
yeah.
know.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
will this imperil our Waffle Wednesdays?
That's a good question.
She's not selling.
Oh, that's right.
No compensation.
That's
right.
Oh, yeah, no compensation.
I am very much in support of it having a food handler's card requirement.
Well, okay. there you go.
Well, I appreciate you speaking to some of the concerns and to be continued. So. Wrap back around with some of the members of the committee, maybe, and with Mr. Tolleson, and we'll see what we need to do to move this bill forward. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is
so
there
much.
Anybody else in the hearing room that wanted that did not sign up that would like to testify to Senate Bill 320? Okay, I don't see anybody, so we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 320. And then we had one more work session to do. We did get the paperwork back on Senate Bill 209. So we are going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 209.
Chair Edwards, I move that Senate Bill 209 be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson recommends that Senate Bill 209 be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? You'll recall that this is the bill that makes the Invasive Species Council appointment of the state invasive species coordinator mandatory. So, okay. Any discussion? Seeing no more discussion. Are there any objections? Seeing no objections. So ordered. And Senator Olson, you want to carry this one as well?
Certainly.
Okay.
Not a problem.
Senator Olson, carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 209. And I don't think we have any more business before us today, so we are adjourned. So we are adjourned.